I set up in Melbourne and I set up in Sydney permanently in one of the hotels, which would be staffed full time by the Prime Minister's office staff. So Sydney, you know, the fellows would also work out of there. So between us all, you would know what was going on. But then you had to make sure that that went back to a central command post, which then had to let the state police know in advance of what was going on. So it was quite a logistical problem in terms of, but let's say, you know, it was what you were trying to do, and you know, was tiring, but it was great fun. You know, and it was great challenge, great fun, and you had a good time as well. I would have had a terrible job if you didn't have a good time doing it.
What's I think you hinted at the amount of hours you spent and the intensity of the work was a significant factor in you deciding, telling the Prime Minister that it was time for you to change.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it was. You know, I said I'd remarried, I had another a young family, and it sounds trite, but I was sick of going to foreign countries. Now that sounds awful, but you get to the stage where you think, oh God, not another overseas trip. And once you get to that stage, it's time to call it a day. And there was still plenty for me to do in the police force. So it's and also you get to the stage of life where, you know, you probably need a younger man in there anyway.
Was your health affected at all by the endless hours you worked?
No, I picked up a few funny bugs overseas from time to time, but that wasn't too bad because we always had a doctor travel with us. I managed to go down with glandular fever in China, which was very handy, and used to get the usual problems. Inevitably get problems, you know, in gastro problems in some countries. Although when we used to travel to some of these places, I mean, the plane used to be stocked with our own food and water and everything else, so you weren't caught, you know. But even so, you still, I picked up a few funny sorts of things along the way, but everybody did, I think. So,
when you were in this building, I think you mentioned that. You didn't usually enter, you would use all the spaces that the Prime Minister would use, but you didn't go into the cabinet room normally.
No, I mean, the cabinet room was really sacrosanct. It wasn't used for anything other than cabinet meetings, and it was secure. So it wasn't used. Otherwise, when I say it was electronically secure, so if people used it, you know, would have to be swept every time. So generally it was kept, the cabinet room. But the cabinet anteroom, just outside, where there was a kitchen and all the rest of the stuff, and the cabinet attendant, you know, that was a place where, when there was no cabinet meetings on or whatever, you could have a room to chat or use the telephone or whatever. Yeah. But, you know. But everybody was working in really, you know, in appalling conditions. His appointments secretary, Prime Minister's appointments secretary, virtually had a bench in a little tiny little space in one of the most important people on his staff. You know, and it was just terrible. I mean, a lady called Jill Saunders, and I don't know, yeah. You'll cope with it. I mean, it was for the staff going to the new house. I mean, it was that there was more. There was more room. There was more room in the chief of staff's office, I think, than there was in the whole place in the old Parliament House.
You have mentioned this partly already, but I'll sort of come and see. Just check again whether there were any others. Were there any parliamentarians came to admire as parliamentary operators or as individuals, or any that you did not have very positive thoughts about during time here?
There were different sorts of operators, of course. There were political operators, and the Graham Richardsons and the Robert Rays and people like that who were the number crunchers and the real political heavyweights. There were the people with the Labour Party backgrounds, but weren't necessarily the number crunchers. But ex-union people, the McYoungs, people like that, John Button. I got to know, in one way or another, all of them. I think they all had their own. I mean, they were all there because they were pretty smart operators. Hawk had a very good team there, particularly in the early days. Lionel Bowen was probably the perfect deputy prime minister. He was no threat to the prime minister, but very, very competent and a really nice man. Got on with Lionel extremely well. Really enjoyed the few times I worked with him when he was acting prime minister. He was a really easy person to work with. Gareth Evans was obviously extremely intellectual, and very, very clever man, but extremely short fuse. And it was really interesting because where we used to sit just inside the door at this place, there was a bank of switches, which were for cabinet members to directly contact their office, and you'd be sitting there when they did it. And Gareth often used to burst out of the cabinet room and come storming down the hallway because somebody hadn't put the right note in his brief or something, and abuse whoever was on his office, at the other end of the phone in his office. I think his staff used to change over a fair bit, fairly frequently, but his cleverness made up for all that, I think. In fact, he was a really good foreign minister and has done some amazing things since. And Beazley was another one who was very intellectual, very, very, very clever. But I think I got on well with Gareth as well. Because we had he accompanied us on a few overseas trips, or turned up for parts of overseas trips as foreign minister from time to time, as did Bill Hayden when Hayden was foreign minister. I got on with Hayden well, because Hayden was an ex-policeman, ex-Queensland copper. I can remember when Hawke was meeting with Gorbachev in the Kremlin. I was sitting with Bill Hayden. Hayden was waiting to go in for, Gorbachev and Hawke were supposed to have, sort of 15 minutes together, and then the two foreign ministers went in. Well, an hour later, Hawke and Gorbachev were still going, and so Bill Hayden was still, and Bill and I were having this great conversation about the Fitzgerald Royal Commission into the Queensland Police. So, and that was an interesting thing to do in the Kremlin, I can tell you. I'm quite sure that the Russians knew all about our conversation as well, but anyway, that's fine. I got to know them all. I mean, they knew who I was, and I got to deal with them all from time to time, and I can't think of anybody that I didn't have the utmost respect for. I mean, politicians are often misjudged in a lot of ways by the public when they don't see. The workload of ministers, particularly cabinet ministers, is just enormous. And the workload of the prime minister is even more so. I mean, Hawke, when he left here on a Friday night to go back to the lodge, if he was spending the weekend in care, well, didn't matter where he was spending the weekend, I mean, the paperwork he had to take with him to get through over the weekend was just enormous. I mean, they don't do it for the money. I can tell you that it's just enormous workload, all of them, and it was the same with both parties. I mean, yeah, there was that's not the fact that I spent the majority of my time with the Labour Party Prime Minister was just an accident of time. Working with John Hewson during the election campaign and Fraser, of course, and Doug Anthony. I mean, they all carried a huge workload. So yes, I've always had the utmost respect. And when people talk about, you know, politicians, you know, they just only turning up for 2 weeks in Canberra and then they go back for their electorates and, you know, they have to work again for another 3 weeks or so. It's, people don't know how hard these people do work.
During your time here, can you think of any funny episodes that happened, something that really you had a good laugh about?
Here in the house?
Yeah, here in during your travels?
Oh, during my travels, well, there were plenty of those. I mentioned earlier on John Bowen, who was the international advisor, subsequently became our ambassador in Bern, in Switzerland. And then he went to work with Sandy Holway on the Olympics. I know, I don't know what John's doing now. But he was a career foreign affairs person and had been a diplomat. And when we were in Russia, we stayed at the guest house the government guest house in Moscow. The Cold War had finished, so they weren't. I don't think they were. The surveillance operations weren't quite as detailed as they used to be, because in fact you could see the little microphones hanging out of the walls, where the plaster was starting to part. But anyway, we all in the guest house. There was one dining room where we all went for breakfast. So that was everybody in the party went for breakfast. And all sitting around this big table. And we had these very stern-faced young Russian waiters in white coats serving us. Quite a few, three or four, I suppose, around there. And you could have what you wanted. There was food laid out, but if you wanted something else. And I think it was Chris Conybeare, who was then the PM's chief of staff, wanted to know if he could get some marmalade. And Bowen said, who had been a junior diplomat in Moscow, he said, I can remember some Russian. I know what the word for marmalade is. Called one of these waiters over and asked him in Russian for what he thought was marmalade. This Russian waiter looked at him with absolutely no expression on his face, just nodded with his silver tray and went out. And 10 minutes went past and Conybeare said, I think I've forgotten about my marmalade. And Bowen said, I could have got it wrong. I think I might have ordered a piece of coal. Anyway, sure enough, about 10 minutes later, about 20 minutes went past, this waiter walked in on his silver tray with a piece of chalk. Obviously, the look on his face was, you know, these are very funny people, these Australians. But, you know, they were the sorts of things that cracked everybody up and really made the trip. I can't remember what else was, you know. I remember coming to land in the VIP plane in Islamabad. And nobody had any forewarning, but all of a sudden these two MiG-15 fighter jets appeared on either wing, literally on either wing. You could see the face of the pilots on there. They were escorting us in, but we didn't know that at the time. So that gave everybody, that excited the press a bit, the cameramen. They managed to get some great shots. Yeah, we made the most of, we made the most of our trips, I must say. I had one embarrassing incident, which we did laugh about afterwards, was we were in Israel, and as is normal, I think, protocol-wise, the Prime Minister goes to have an official meeting with the Mayor of Jerusalem. And I can't remember his name, but he was very famous at the time. I don't remember his name anyway, and he was quite a cranky old bunger. Anyway, I had Israeli security, which is pretty tight, working with me. And we were going up to the fourth floor of the city chambers or whatever it is in Jerusalem Town Hall, and the mayor had come down outside to meet us, walked through and took him into the lift with Hazel, and the Israeli security bloke got in, and I was just going to get in. He said, "I don't want anybody else in the lift." And I didn't know whether they were, you know, heading upstairs somewhere. I don't need anybody in the lift. And anyway, the Israeli bloke and Hawks said, "Come on." So, and Hawks are good like that. He said, "No, no, that's Roger's my bloke, you come with me." And this mayor said, "Well, if he's coming in, I'm getting out." So Hawks said, didn't say anything. So we all went up in the lift, and the mayor got up and went up the stairs for four flights, which I found rather embarrassing, but Hawks said, "Don't worry about it, mate." So, you know, that was embarrassing for me, but it was just the way that Hawk worked with you, you know, that he expected, there was no reason why I shouldn't be in the lift either. I mean, it wasn't to say you couldn't get in there. It was reasonably crowded, but, you know, but, you know, these things just pop out like that, and, you know, you deal with them. And we had a lovely trip to Ireland, to Dublin. And I was doing the advance over there, and I worked with them working with the Garda, and the head of their special branch over there was a very... This was in the 80s again, when the IRA troubles were at their height. And but this was in the south. And there was a superintendent there in charge of special branch, was a fellow called Thomas Kelly. And he was a real old autocrat, older policeman, but famous. Only one thing he hated more than Protestants was IRA. He hated the IRA and hounded them, and was very well known for it. But he went, and we were going, apart from doing a trip to Dublin, and there was the football game on there, you know, the AFL football game on at Croke Park, so we were going to that, arrived and went straight to that. But then we were also going down to Tipperary to the Prime Minister had invited, our Prime Minister down to the to Tipperary to Sangster's horse stud down there to look at some horse flesh, knowing Hawk was, you know, loved horses and all that. So we decided we were going to go down to Tipperary to do an advance, and the superintendent was going to come. The superintendent wanted to come. He had it. I was dealing with his inspector, and his inspector was like his tea boy. I mean, he had an inspector to make his tea for him and to run around after him like a Batman. It was unbelievable. But lovely people. I mean, it was just... But they couldn't do enough. But anyway... But the superintendent decided that we would go to Tipperary in his personal car, not a police car. And I said to his inspector, Why are we going in the boss's car? He says, "Ah, sir, because he gets a mileage allowance for it." So anyway, we had to go to his house first to meet his wife, and then we all got into his personal car and drove down to Tipperary, where we stayed at a hotel, and then we were to meet the local sergeant who was going to work with me the next morning. And we met the superintendent and the mayor and a public servant that was with me, met for breakfast downstairs, and I could see this bloke walking around outside the dining room door, shuffling up and down. And I said to the superintendent, I said, "Mr. Kelly, is that the fellow we were, you know, we're going to be working with?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, you know, I'd really like to meet him. Can we get him in for a cup of coffee?" He said, "No. No, no, he can stay up there until we're ready." So this is... So anyway, eventually I got to meet this sergeant, who was a lovely fellow, and I said, "Look, I'll go with him in his car. I would really needed to go. I'm going to work with this fellow. I really needed to get to know him and get him on side. And I said to him, I'll introduce myself. And I said, do you know why we're coming here? And he said, no. He said, Mr. Kelly keeps his cards very close to his chest. And I said, oh, okay. He said, are you coming to buy police horses? So I said, I explained what we were doing, and then he was okay. So he said, I'll take you around. But this fellow was an extremely devout Catholic, and the only problem I had with him was every time he passed a church in Tipperary, which was about every 50 metres or so, he'd take his hands off the steering wheel and cross himself. I thought this was going to be fun when he was driving a security car, but anyway, we got round it. But it was a fantastic trip. The Irish are so hospitable. And we went to an Irish pub in Dublin. Hawke wanted to go to visit an Irish pub. And it was just amazing. And it happened several times when we were travelling overseas. He walked into an Irish pub and everybody knew who he was. Everybody knew he was Bob Hawke, the Prime Minister of Australia. It was just incredible. I can remember walking around in Seoul with him in Korea, and people shouting out, "G'day, Hawke, you're going anywhere you went in the world." Everybody knew Hawke. It's very popular, very well known, very well known. Yeah. So they were all interesting trips, all interesting days.
It reminds me that you brought in some very interesting photos that from your collection of times when, including where travels with Hawke and others.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we haven't been able to kind of identify all the locations and the people in them.
Okay.
So I wonder if you could have a look at them, and they're numbered here. So this is photo number one. If you could tell us where that was taken and.
That was in the early days, I think, of Hawke's prime ministership, and it's at the ANU. He was giving he was opening something. You can see the plaque covered up with a curtain behind him. He was opening something. It was open in the air, and the students and I have no recollection of what it was they were demonstrating about. But normally, if you went on any campus anywhere, that you would get a student demonstration. I mean, it's what students do. And so he stood up there addressing some people, with students throwing eggs at him, and the splashes on the path in front of him are broken eggs, and it's me standing alongside him, and just behind him to right is one of my people, a fellow called Bob Hunter, who's just retired from the police. That's from the same thing. The fellow on the right there is another one of my staff. Was a fellow called Graham Sindel, who spent, he was with Hawke for the whole time, and one of my very close friends, who's also retired now. But I think I'm holding my arm up there trying to deflect an egg that was coming my way. During the Hewson campaign in 93, actually, there was a very famous shot we were at a big demonstration in Brisbane where somebody threw an egg at Hewson. He was up on a stage and I was standing alongside him, so I know this is true, threw an egg at him and he caught it. He was an extremely good sportsman. He caught it and took it in his hand and brought his hand back all in time and handed me the egg, which I then chucked down in front of the stage, and it smashed on the floor, so I can guarantee it was a fresh egg. Of course, there was a lot of conjecture by the press that it was either a hard-boiled egg or it was all put on, and it wasn't, but it was right. So yeah, so I've dodged a few eggs and a fair range of fruit and vegetables in my time over the years at various demonstrations. But
photo number three is clearly from overseas.
That's in Dubrovnik. We did a trip to Yugoslavia. That was before. Before the war, I think a lot of those buildings have got a lot of bullet holes in them now. And we started off in Belgrade, with the Yugoslavian police, and they said, oh, you know, we're in charge, and when we get to Croatia, we'll be in charge. But as soon as we got to Dubrovnik, they disappeared into the background and left it to Croatians, because they just hated each other, the two organisations. So we're walking through the main square in Dubrovnik there. You can see...
Who are the people in there?
The fellows in the suits at the front, the two on the left and the one on the right are Croatian police, security police. The person just to my left shoulder is, in fact, Craig Emerson, who's the Minister for Small Business now in the Rudd government. But he was then an economic advisor to the Prime Minister. Immediately behind him is Barry Cassidy, who I think was there as a journalist rather than the press secretary. Then there's Hazel, and then the fellow on Hazel's shoulder is also one of my staff, Larry Ringering. And that's how we used to operate. One in front, just in front, leading the way, knowing where you're going, which was usually me because I'd done the advance, and then one behind, and there's another one over here, which is another fellow, Graham Sindel again, which is mine. So we've got one to the left and one to the right of the Prime Minister and Mrs. Hawke behind them, and me just a little bit in front, leading the way, and the Croatian blokes spread out because, you know, it's just a crowded square. No, probably I would expect that not too many people that were there would know who were, they would know there was some VIP coming through. But
The photographers on most of these were official photographers.
That would have been taken by one of the official photographers travelling with us, who in those days were part of foreign affairs and trade. I think nowadays the official photographers, that goes out to contract to private organisations. But
photo number four is clearly from Russia.
Yes, Red Square.
What year was that?
That was, I think it was, I believe it was 1986, 87, sometime like that. It would have been mid-80s. But it was in Gorbachev's reign. We went there, and then we went on to, which was then Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, of course. And that was a group photo taken by the official photographer, which comprised of mainly of personal staff. Fellow on the right was the Prime Minister's personal doctor, Dr. Joe Feldman, who used to travel with us everywhere overseas. So we had our own doctor with us, the federal policeman, myself, one of the girls from the, one of the stenos from the office, Bob and Hazel, Stephen, can't think of his name, speechwriter, Craig Emerson again. This fellow here is Bob Heggie, who was my successor. He also worked with Whitlam in the Whitlam days, Bob. He was on the steps here during the dismissal. Barry Cassidy. This fellow here on the left, Frank Leverett, now head of protocol at Prime Minister and Cabinet. Was one of the Prime Minister and Cabinet people with us. It was a team. It was a whole team thing, those visits. Didn't matter who you were, what part you played, you were part of the whole team.
Photo number five is clearly taken at the wreath-laying ceremony somewhere.
Yeah, that's Moscow as well. That's the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Moscow, where you must go. And it's quite intimidating, the Russian troops... are all 6 foot and over, and when you inspect a guard of honour, they don't look straight ahead. They look at the VIP. Every one of them looks at the VIP, is what they're taught to do, and as they come past, their heads turn and they're looking at them all the way around, and it is really quite intimidating. It's because they have very stern looks on their face, and but I think it's a respect thing from their point of view, that you don't stare ahead. You look at the visitor, but it looks as though they're looking, you know, right through you.
This was the same visit as...
That was the same visit to Moscow, yeah. That was the same visit.
The last one is file number six. It's clearly taken somewhere else. What event?
That's at Government House, and that was in 92 with the visit of the Queen. And of course, you know, the Queen's in the front there with Prince Philip. And the team there, the people around them, are the people who were involved, the officials that were involved in the visit, including myself and one of my colleagues, the fellow that organised the cars, the ADC that was appointed, people from Ceremony and Hospitality. So when there's a roar. And I was a senior escort officer to the Queen on that visit. In fact, I had flown over to, because the government had chartered a Qantas 747 for the Royal Party to come over to Australia, because the 707s were, you know, sort of not fit for a Queen, I guess, that I had flown over and, in fact, travelled back and met up with the Queen and her people. And her security people at Windsor. Well, I went to the palace to meet with some people. Then she left from Windsor, so I went down to Windsor with the Royalty Protection Group, with the commander of the police, commander of the Queen's security, who I knew extremely well, and then travelled from Windsor to the airport, and then travelled with the Royal Party to Australia, and then did the visit in 92 with her. Mm.
Well, interesting. What's your relationship to the Queen's Protection Service?
Again, he performed the same role as I would if I was in his country. Security of the Queen was the responsibility of Australia. He was there in the liaison role, but obviously, you know, like if the Queen wanted to know something, then she would ask him, not me. As the Prime Minister would if I was anywhere overseas with him, he'd ask me. He wouldn't know the local people well enough to ask them. So that was his role. It was purely liaison. And when the Queen comes, it's only one person comes with her. She doesn't bring a group.
And you would travel with the Queen in the same way as you would travel with the Prime Minister,
yep,
and be present at all functions and,
yep,
events.
Yep. Yep. And having done a very, very detailed advance some months before. In fact, it's really interesting. I have when you're a senior person on the trip, you have an audience with the Queen at the end of the thing, and she gives you a gift. And the audience was at Admiralty House where we finished the trip. I think the advance, the people had come over from the palace, one of the private secretaries had come over from the palace in October or November the year before, and we planned out the whole trip, because the Queen's trip obviously is down to the second everything you do. And so we'd been round, and we took her to Dubbo and all sorts of places, and we'd done all that. And at that time I was a smoker, and when I got home from that trip, and my wife was a smoker as well, when I got home from that advance trip, I got home and on a Saturday morning, and we only smoked outside because we had the two little girls, and we only smoked outside the house. And I said, oh, I'm going out for a cigarette. And my wife said, are you coming? She said, no, I haven't smoked since you've been away. And I said, are you giving up? And she said, yes, I am. So I said, well, I better do the same. And I've never smoked. Literally, I've never smoked since. However, obviously, the visiting party picked up that I was a smoker. And my gift from the Queen was a E2R Dunhill cigarette lighter in the red leather case with the E2R on, which I can honestly say is only at a little barbecue, which is, yeah, it's a nice little story, that one.
You also brought along what looks like a cartoon.
It is a cartoon.
From John Hewson.
Yes, indeed, yes. In 1993, John Hewson was the leader of the opposition when Paul Keating called the election, and because of my experience, I was asked to head a team with the leader of the opposition, Dr. John Hewson. And the leader of the opposition is afforded exactly the same level of security as the alternative prime minister, exactly the same level of security as the prime minister is. So I had a team of six. I selected a team of six. And we got I got on very well with him. I went over and briefed him and all his staff before the election campaign and told them what exactly they could expect from the police. He knew that I had spent 7 years with the other side of politics, and that didn't faze him in the slightest. He knew I was a professional, and politics didn't play a part in it, and was more than happy to have me there. So I picked my team, but he and it was quite a violent campaign, that one in 93. We had demonstrations against him everywhere we went, and some really quite violent ones. But he was a very fit man and a runner, and so I had to pick a couple of people on my staff that could keep up with him, because he'd run marathons and all the lot, and I thought I was far too old to be able to necessarily keep up with the aspiring prime minister. So I picked, but so, and we had a very, very, you know, interesting campaign. Lots of problems. Got him out of lots of trouble, and at the end they had a function for everybody that was involved in the campaign, including the police, and unbeknown to us, he had commissioned Ian Sharp, who's the illustrator from the Canberra Times, who also was a neighbour of mine and a good friend of mine, to commission a cartoon which was framed for each of the police, which he says to Roger, "Thanks for all your help and protection during the campaign. We were